Good afternoon, everyone. Nice to see you. I got to see some of you on my last trip here a few weeks ago. Good to have an opportunity to speak with you a little bit. I want to speak about, actually to start with a haunted house. A very unusual story of a haunted house that appears in the Sfarim. It was about the year 1900. And we're in Russia. And there was unfortunately a young man who was studying in the summer. And he was studying at a nearby university. And he was staying by one of the Balabatim in this town. There wasn't dorms. There weren't dorms for the yeshivas. There weren't dorms for the university. And he was staying by a local Jewish family. The boy was Jewish, not particularly observant, but he was a Jewish boy. And staying upstairs in the attic. And unfortunately, the boy committed suicide, as the story went. It's a true story. The boy committed suicide. He slit his wrists, and the blood dripped from his wrists into the floorboards in the attic. The next day, something happened that was very, very strange. There was a very loud noise, and the house started to shake, and plaster and paint started coming down from the ceiling underneath these boards into the living room. But there was nothing on the ceiling that looked like it was coming apart. The ceiling looked perfectly okay, but it started raining plaster and other things. And as the story goes, this happened several times a day. There would be a very, very loud noise. There would be a shaking. People would start coming to the house to watch this very, very strange phenomenon. Eventually, a couple of his friends from the university sort of made a vigil. They would just play cards in the living room of this house in order to be able to watch when this shaking would happen. And all this stuff would begin to come down. So eventually the owner of the home, who was a Jewish fellow, got really nervous about this, and he asked one of the workers in the home, who was a frum guy, if he could go to the local rabbi to find out what to do. So the local rabbi was eventually Rav Blach from Telz. He wrote the Sefer Shiurei Das, a very interesting Sefer of Hashkafa. This was before he had come to Telz. And they went to the rabbi and asked him what they should do. And he said, I don't know much about ghosts, and I don't know much about these strange kinds of incidents, but I do know halacha. And there's a halachic problem here. Fortunately, we know in Eretz Yisrael, when there's blood from someone at the time that they died, so that blood has to be buried, even if it's soaked into something else. So the rabbi said, I don't know. I can't tell you anything about what's going on in ghosts and haunted houses, he says, but you have to bury those floorboards. Halachically, you have to bury those floorboards. So they made a whole big ceremony the next day, and they buried the floorboards, and they allowed the blood of this young man to come to Kavuras Yisrael, and never again did the house shake. And Rav Blach talks about this not because he's interested in talking about haunted houses, and not because he's looking for an introduction to a sicha, but because he wants to highlight what changed in the community after this entire incident. It's a small community in Russia, and they had this absolutely bizarre thing. Everyone in the community knew what was going on. His friends from the university were there playing cards in the house, and he wanted to highlight what changed after the rabbi gave this advice. And they took the floorboards, and the sounds and the whole light show stopped. Because nothing changed. People were amazed. It made for a great story. Fascinating. The fellows continued to play cards. They continued to go to university. They continued to go about their business. Because the reality is that miraculous kinds of things historically have done almost nothing to affect people's behavior, even to change people's belief systems. You see that in the Parshias now. You saw that in Parshias Beshalach. After the sea splits, Kadosh Baruch Hu can do anything he wants, can do anything he wants with water. The people get to the other side, and they're kvetching because they don't know how they're going to drink. God just split the sea. He can do water. He's good with water. He can figure this out. If he can make the water split, he can figure out how to give you something. People don't respond to that. They're at the foot of Sinai, and we all know what's going to happen. We're between Parshas Yisro and Parshas Kisisa. We're going to do the sin of the golden calf again. It's going to happen at the foot of the mountain. But they saw so much stuff. Later in history, Eliyahu HaNavi, on Mount Carmel, up north, Eliyahu HaNavi would gather the entire Jewish people who were worshiping idols and serving God. And he would make two altars. And he would challenge the prophets of the Baal, the prophets of the idol worshiper, to have God respond to them. And they took a cow, and they put the cow on the altar, and all day long they tried to get God, their gods, to respond, and nothing happens. And then Eliyahu takes water to fill up an entire area to make a huge pool, and he puts his animal, and he says, God, okay, it's time, it's mincha time, we got to put on the show. A fire comes out from heaven. And the people scream like the end of Yom Kippur, that's where it comes from. Hashem Hu Elokim, Hashem Hu Elokim. And the next day, everything's back to normal. Miracles seem to have very little effect on people's behavior, on the behavior, on the belief of Jews. You see that again and again in Tanakh, you see that again and again in history. For just a few moments, I want to struggle with you and try to understand why. Because I know I've felt sometimes that it would be nice if God came out and said hello. He's hidden. He's doing a really good job. And sometimes we wonder if he doesn't need to do such a good job. Can't he show us a little bit of something? Can't I have something when I get up in the morning? Just a wink, a nod. Something. Why don't miracles affect us? Why doesn't God do more miracles for us? One approach which the Rambam takes is that miracles will really never convince anyone because they can always be refuted. The Rambam says this in the context of believing in Moshe Rabbeinu. It makes a very important point. The Rambam says, and you should all know this, that we don't believe in Moshe or the Torah because he did miracles. He did a lot of miracles, but that's not why we believe him. Because if that were the reason why we believe that there was a Sinai, that's the reason why we believe there's a Torah, then somebody could come by and do a better miracle. Somebody could come by and do a different miracle, and that could be the end of the Judaism as we know. That's not why. Why do we believe in Moshe? Anybody know? It's important to remember this. We believe in Moshe because millions of people stood at the bottom of the mountain and heard God speak to Moshe. Not because he split the sea, not because he brought us the manna. Those are tricks, good tricks. But those are miracles. Miracles can sometimes be duplicated. We believe in Moshe because we stood at the bottom of that mountain. Your great-grandparents, my great-grandparents, they stood at the bottom of that mountain and they heard God speak to Moshe. But not because of miracles, because miracles can always be refuted, can always be done by somebody else. They only go so far. Perhaps that's reason number one. Reason number two. Why don't miracles affect behavior? The answer, one of the answers is, if you think about it, is that our behavior is much more about whether we're thinking at a given moment than what we really believe or what we really know is right. The reason why we mess up is not because we don't believe in God. We do or we don't. But it's not because we don't believe in Him. It's because we're not thinking. We're not in the moment. We're not aware. The mistakes that we make, sometimes we'll do something terrible. We know we didn't want to do it. We just because we can't control ourselves or because we're not thinking. But not because we don't believe, we don't know. When I do an Aveira, it's not because maybe there's a God, maybe there's not something. That's not what's going on in our minds. Again, we may doubt, that's not why we do a particular thing wrong. So miracles don't tend to change behavior because people make mistakes. People aren't thinking. People are informed by other things. Not because they lack proof that there's a God. That's why I make this particular mistake, I do this particular thing. Number three. The reason why miracles don't tend to affect our belief very much is because we tend to believe what we want to believe and not what we see. We tend to believe the things that we want to believe. We tend to look at things in our own way based on what it is that we want to believe. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman has a famous essay. And Rabbi Wasserman asks, how could it be that God commands us to believe in him? Follow me for a second. How can we be commanded to believe something? Either I believe something or I don't. I can be commanded to do something. I can be told I gotta do this. I can agree with you, I cannot agree with you, but I gotta do it. How can I be commanded to believe? What if I don't believe? I can make myself believe. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman says something that's very important. I used to spend a lot of time on secular college campuses debating kids about God. Whether there's a God or whether there isn't a God. And one of the things I would say before we start is, let's take one thing off the table. Let's say you're going to live the life of a Torah Jew, whether there is a God or there isn't a God. Why would I do that? Why would I keep Shabbos if there's no God? I said, no. Before we start our conversation about whether there is a God or not a God, you're still going to keep all the mitzvot. I said, why do you say that? I said, because if you won't, don't you have a great incentive to not believe in God? Are you telling me that you can really be objective about any proof that I'm going to try to bring to you? It's not so convenient always to believe in God. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman says that when God tells us to believe in him, what he's really just asking from us is to be objective. To look at the world around us and not factor in, well, if there's a God, then, oh, that's going to be very complicated. That's going to get in the way of my plans tonight. That's not going to work the way I want it to. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman says there's enough objective proof out there. The world is complicated enough, is sophisticated enough, that it's not so hard to believe in God unless you want to believe something else. And if you do want to believe something else, it's so difficult to think objectively. There's a fascinating piece by the Stipler. The Stipler has a fascinating piece, one of my favorite Dvorlos from him on the Torah, in Parshas Va'era. At the end of Parshas Va'era, we have the Makkah of Barad. Right? Explosive. Missiles are going to come down from the sky. Explosive hail. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu makes a deal with the people. He says to the Egyptians the following, listen closely. He says to the Egyptians, there's a plague coming, and there's going to be things that are going to fall from the sky. There's going to be hail that falls from the sky, and it's going to destroy everything on your front lawn. Anything you leave out, you leave something on your driveway, it's going to get destroyed. What do you need to do to prevent this from happening? You don't need to let the Jews go. You don't need to let the Jews go. Well, if you want to have the hail not come at all, you got to let the Jews go. But in order to stop the hail from ruining your property, you don't have to let the Jews go. You don't have to change your economy. You don't have to do anything. All you got to do, take your lawn furniture in. Take your animal off the driveway and put it in the barn. Take your car off the driveway and put it in the garage. That's all you got to do. Moshe Rabbeinu is 6 for 6 at this point. The guy is good. He says things are going to happen. They happen. What idiot would keep their car on the driveway? He says it's coming. Take the car, put the car away. You don't have to let the Jews go. Just protect your car. And the Psukim say that the few Egyptians who feared God put their cars in the drive, put their car in the garage. And everybody else left everything out on the lawn. Idiots. Says the disciple, if you don't want to believe something, then there's no proof that's going to make you believe. The Egyptians couldn't face the fact that there was a God fighting for the Jews. Their whole economy was based on the Jews. Their whole world, they always grew up thinking they had these slaves. It was incredibly inconvenient to think that there's a God out there who's fighting for them. And the fact that he was 6 for 6 and there have been 6 plagues, don't bother with the facts. And they let this stuff outside. So the fact is that even if there would be miracles, miracles will only work, no matter how great the miracle is, if we're willing to look at them objectively, if we're willing to look at the facts objectively. If we want to believe something, God can do whatever miracle it is. It's not going to affect the way we think about things. 3 reasons. I'm going to get to the 4th in a second. But 1, miracles, as exciting as they would be if we see them, can always be refuted or outdone. Miracles only change theoretically what we believe, but not how we act anyway. And miracles can only affect our belief if we're open to that. But if we really don't want to believe, then nothing we see is going to make a difference. But there's another reason why. Every morning when I get up in the morning, I don't get that little God waving in the window. And the reason is because if God were, let's say every morning something amazing would happen. Let's say instead of my iPhone going off as an alarm, let's say every morning my iPhone would float into the air. Every morning God just goes, I just want a little miracle. I want a big miracle. I want to see, just give me something. This way I'll get up and go to Shabbos. Deal, God. If you get up, all I do, my watch. I'm going to leave my watch on the night table. And when I get up in the morning, if the watch floats up, so that's a good reminder that there's a God. And now I'll go to Shabbos. Works for me. The reason why that doesn't make any sense is because if my watch actually floated off my night table every single morning, that would become nature too. The only difference between nature and miracles is how often it happens. See, we tend to think that a miracle is when God works hard. Wow, it's good to see. Imagine God really got up early that morning, right? And he said, this is the day. We're going to split the sea today. And he does his workout, he does his stretches, he's ready. Today we're going to split the sea. This is going to be a tough day, but you know, we're going to get through. We're going to get through. Let me ask you a question. I'm going to challenge half the room here, okay? We're going to challenge half the room. We're going to give each of you an assignment. One group, these guys, have got to figure out how to split the Red Sea. It's not going to be easy, but that's your job. We have to split the Red Sea, find a bunch of Israelis, they'll figure it out. Right? They'll figure it out. And not only they figure it out, they'll make money doing it. They'll figure it out. They'll make an app for that, and you're going to split it. That's your job. Tough, but okay. This group has got to figure out how to keep the sea moving for 6,000 years. Now, which one is tougher? Is it tougher to split the sea for an hour? Or keep it moving for 6,000 years? See, the difference is because it moves every day, so that we figured God could do that in his sleep. But is that really easier than making the thing split? See, the fact is many of the things that we call nature are a lot more difficult and a lot more complicated. You know, if I could go over and make that chair rise, I'm saying, everybody, I'm going to do a miracle. We're all going to say hallelujah after I do this. I'm going to come, I'm going to pick this thing up, I'm going to make the thing rise, and it's going to rise into the air. You guys would be pretty impressed. I could even convince you to go to Mars. Right? When you pick this thing up in the air, right? Is that really a big deal? It's a big deal because you don't see it every day. Please God, you guys will be zochet to get married, be zochet to have a child. This ain't nothing compared to childbirth. A child coming into the world. Rav Dessler in his Michtam Eliyahu says that it's very interesting that when I plant a seed in the ground and I water it, it comes up, right? You know, you do this in every nursery. You know, you have a couple little potted things and you put the seed in the ground and you put some water in it and then you get the little thing, the little plastic cup. I put a body in the ground, also dead. And a little bit of dew comes from heaven and a person comes out of the ground. Well, that would be pretty shocking to us. Is it really so different? Just that one occurs every day and one rarely occurs. Or hasn't occurred yet. The difference between miracles and nature is not that one is more incredible. It's just that I get used to whatever it is. If God did miracles for us all the time, that would just be the new normal. I'd get used to that also. There's more than enough out there already that should shock us. We just see it every single day. Rav Tukhachinsky, who was a Rav here in Eretz Yisrael in early 1900s, Rav Tukhachinsky has a fascinating mushel, a fascinating case he gives. It's a little eerie. Imagine two young men are born, one with a profound, profound disability. And he can't really take in anything from the outside world. He's blind, can't hear. And the other develops normally. And at 30 years old, the boy who had this profound disability is suddenly cured. And now he can see and now he can hear. And he's walking around and he can't believe it. He doesn't know where to look first. Everything. Things are growing. Things are moving. There are sounds. There are things. He's amazed by the tiniest little thing. And the other guy who grew up with him is saying, what is the big deal? What are you making such a big deal about? Says Rav Tukhachinsky, who now has the disability? There's a disability when you can't take in the outside world, and there's a disability when you can. Because the world really is an amazing place. It's just that we're so used to it that we no longer see it as amazing. He points out that it's very interesting that a child, you know, have you ever been with a five-year-old? Five-year-olds, six-year-olds, even eight, ten-year-olds are fascinated by everything they see. Just about the time that we become ready to think about God, we've already become pretty used to the world that He put us into. Works well for our free choice. Because by the time we have to try to figure out if there's a God, we're so used to this world, we stop being amazed by it, we could decide not to see Him if we choose so. But those are real miracles too. And those miracles are around us. You know, one thing I try to do on the way to Shacharis in the morning, other than just walk straight and stay awake, is to look around me a little bit. Look at the trees. Look at the miracles that are here. Try to notice that. Try to notice God. Because there really is a lot there that should affect who we are. Just that it very often goes right over our heads. So it would be wonderful if miracles changed who we are. It's not that there aren't miracles, it's just that we don't see them. Rather than pray for more miracles, we need miracles of Yeshua, that's for sure. We need Yeshua for Eretz Yisrael every single day. We need to see more of His hand. But rather than pray, simply pray for more miracles, what we should pray is to be aware of miracles. Be aware of our surroundings. To take the fact that we know deep down that God is there, and to be able to act on that in a real sort of way. I'll be here this afternoon. I'm having lunch with many fellows who are interested in finding out more about YU. Going to Torah Shraga and being in the YU building is a little bit like going to MTA. In the sense that you kind of know YU, you kind of think you know what it is, but it's important to take a real look at all the opportunities that are there. The environment that you find yourselves in, I say this, wherever you choose to go, over the next couple of years is crucially important. It's probably the most important decision that you're going to make is where you're going to find yourself, which environment, which miracles are you going to see? Where are you going to have your eyes opened over the next few years? If you think about it, and I'll end with this, you guys are about 19. When you're done with college in just a few years, you'll be 22, 23. You'll have at that point made a lot of the big decisions in your life. Probably what you want to do for a living, perhaps who you want to marry, what kind of community you want to be in, where you want to be religiously. All of those are decisions you guys are going to make over the next couple of years. Where you find yourself over the next few years is the most important decision that you'll probably ever make. The environment that you put yourselves into the next few years will help form not what you do for a living, but who you are. And what we're proud to be able to do on the YU campus is to realize that we don't go to college to get a job, even though guys do really get jobs. We go to college to become the kind of person we want to be. And that's why it's important to take a good look, not just at the schools and their curricula and their job statistics and the majors, but take a look at the kids on the campus. Say, where are there kids that are kind of the way I want to turn out? Where is the group that I want to form to be my chevra? That's going to be your chevra in many cases for the rest of your life. So take that decision very seriously. I'm happy to talk to you about YU. I'm happy to openly talk to you about other possibilities as well. We'll be doing lunch somewhere for those who want free lunch. Somewhere, where is that? Anybody know?
Rabbi David's classroom.
What?
I think it's Rabbi David's classroom.
Ooh, Rabbi David's classroom, yes. Okay, good. That's another. That alone is a reason to come. And I'll also be in and out for the next few days if anybody would like to talk first. Thank you very much,
everybody. Everybody wants to speak to Rabbi Penner has the ability to do